welcome to Albion Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Today's narration is Starling's Willing Executioners, Part 3, which is a review by Professor Kevin MacDonald of the book The Jewish Century. Bolshevism as a Jewish Revolution. Slezkin's main contribution is to summarize previously available data and to extend our understanding of Jewish dominance of the revolutionary movements before 1917 and of Soviet society thereafter. Oddly, he makes only a passing reference to Albert Lindemann's important Esau's Tears, which makes many of the same points. Not only were Jews vastly overrepresented among revolutionaries, they were particularly well represented at the top among theoreticians, journalists, and leaders. Radical Jews, like other Jews, were very talented, highly intelligent, hardworking, and in addition, dedicated to creating effective ethnic networks. These traits propelled them to the top of radical organizations and made the organizations themselves more effective. But if Jews dominated radical and revolutionary organizations, they were immeasurably aided by philo-Semites like Gorky, who in Albert Lindemann's term were Jewified non-Jews, a term freed of its ugly connotations that might be used to underline an often overlooked point. Even in Russia there were some non-Jews, whether Bolsheviks or not, who respected Jews, praised them abundantly, imitated them, cared about their welfare, and established intimate friendships or romantic liaisons with them. As noted above, many of the non-Jewish elite in the USSR had Jewish wives. What united the Jews and philo-Semites was their hatred for what Lenin, who had a Jewish grandfather, called the thick-skulled, boorish, inert, and bearishly savage Russian or Ukrainian peasant. The same peasant Gorky described as savage, somnolent, and glued to his pile of manure. It was attitudes like these that created the climate that justified the slaughter of many millions of peasants under the new regime. Philo-Semites continued to be common among the non-Jewish elite in the USSR, even in the 1950s, when Jews began to be targeted as Jews. One such philo-Semite was Pavel Sudoplatov, a Slav married to a Jew and with many Jewish friends, who was a high-ranking secret police official with a great deal of blood on his hands. The only murder he unequivocally condemned in his memoirs was that of Paul Mikolz, a Jewish ethnic activist associated with the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee. Figures like Gorky and Sudoplatov were critical to the success of Jews in the Soviet Union. This is a general principle of Jewish political activity in a diaspora situation. Because Jews tend to constitute a tiny percentage of a society, they need to make alliances with non-Jews, whose perceived interests dovetail with theirs. Non-Jews have a variety of reasons for being associated with Jewish interests, including career advancement, close personal relationships, or admiration for individual Jews, and deeply held personal convictions. Gorky's love for the Jews, what Slezkin terms the bitter, ardent, and hopeless love of self-described Apollonians for beautiful Mercurians, was boundless. Gorky saw Jews as possessors of heroic idealism, all-probing, all-scrutinizing. This idealism, which expresses itself in their tireless striving to remake the world according to new principles of equality and justice, is the main, and possibly the only, reason for the hostility towards Jews. Despite the important role of Jews among the Bolsheviks, most Jews were not Bolsheviks before the revolution. However, Jews were prominent among the Bolsheviks, and once the revolution was underway, the vast majority of Russian Jews became sympathizers and active participants. Jews were particularly visible in the cities and as leaders in the army and in the revolutionary councils and committees. For example, there were 23 Jews among the 62 Bolsheviks in the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, elected at the Second Congress of Soviets in October 1917. Jews were the leaders of the movement, and to a great extent they were its public face. Slezkin quotes historian Mikhail Beiser, who notes, commenting on the situation in Leningrad, that Jewish names were constantly popping up in newspapers, Jews spoke relatively more often than others at rallies, conferences, and meetings of all kinds. In general, Jews were deployed in supervisory positions rather than positions that placed them in physical danger. In a Politburo meeting of April 18, 1919, Trotsky urged that Jews be redeployed because there were relatively few Jews in frontline combat units, while Jews constituted a vast percentage of the Cheka at the front and in the executive committees at the front and at the rear. This pattern had caused chauvinist agitation in the Red Army. Jewish representation at the top levels of the Cheka and OGPU, the acronyms by which the secret police were known by in different periods, has often been the focus of those stressing Jewish involvement in the revolution and its aftermath. Slezkin provides statistics on Jewish overrepresentation in these organizations, especially in supervisory roles, and agrees with Leonard Shapiro's comment that anyone who had the misfortune to fall into the hands of the Cheka stood a very good chance of finding himself confronted with, and possibly shot by, a Jewish investigator. During the 1930s, the secret police, then known as the NKVD, was one of the most Jewish of all Soviet institutions, with 42 of its 111 top officials being Jewish. At this time, 12 of the 20 NKVD directorates were headed by ethnic Jews, including those in charge of state security, police, labour camps, and resettlement or deportation. The Gulag was headed by ethnic Jews from its beginning in 1930 until the end of 1938, a period that encompasses the worst excesses of the Great Terror. They were, in Slezkin's words, Stalin's willing executioners. The Bolsheviks continued to apologise for Jewish overrepresentation until the topic became taboo in the 1930s, and it was not until the late 1930s that there was a rise in visibility and assertiveness of anti-Semites, ethnic nationalists, and advocates of proportional representation. By this time, the worst of the slaughters in the Gulag, the purges, and the contrived famines had been completed. The prominence of Jews in the revolution and its aftermath was not lost on participants on both sides, including influential figures such as Winston Churchill, who wrote that the role of Jews in the revolution is certainly a very great one. It probably outweighs all others. Slezkin highlights similar comments in a book published in 1927 by V.V. Shulgin, a Russian nationalist, who experienced firsthand the murderous acts of the Bolsheviks in his native Kiev in 1919. "We do not like the fact that this whole terrible thing was done on the Russian back, and that it has cost us unutterable losses. We do not like the fact that you, Jews, a relatively small group within the Russian population, participated in this vile deed out of all proportion to your numbers." Slezkin does not disagree with this assessment, but argues that Jews were hardly the only revolutionaries. This is certainly true, but does not affect my argument that Jewish involvement was a necessary condition, not merely a sufficient condition, for the success of the Bolshevik Revolution and its aftermath. Slezkin's argument clearly supports the Jews as necessary condition claim, especially because of his emphasis on the leadership role of Jews. However, the claim that Jewish involvement was a necessary condition is itself an understatement, because, as Shulgin noted, the effectiveness of Jewish revolutionaries was far out of proportion to the number of Jews. A claim that a group constituting a large proportion of the population was necessary to the success of a movement would be unexceptional. But the critical importance of Jews occurred even though Jews constituted less than 5% of the Russian population around the time of the revolution, and they were much less represented in the major urban areas of Moscow and Leningrad prior to the revolution because they were prevented from living there by the Pale of Settlement laws. Slezkin is correct that Jews were not the only revolutionaries, but his point only underscores the importance of Philo-Semitism and other alliances Jews typically must make in diaspora situations in order to advance their perceived interests. In 1923, several Jewish intellectuals published a collection of essays admitting the bitter sin of Jewish complicity in the crimes of the revolution. In the words of a contributor, I. L. Beichermann, "It goes without saying that not all Jews are Bolsheviks, and not all Bolsheviks are Jews. but what is equally obvious is that disproportionate and immeasurably fervent Jewish participation in the torment of half-dead Russia by the Bolsheviks. Many of the commentators on Jewish Bolsheviks noted the transformation of Jews. In the words of another Jewish commentator, G.A. Landau, cruelty, sadism, and violence had seemed alien to a nation so far removed from physical activity. And another Jewish commentator, I.A. Bromberg, noted that the formerly oppressed lover of liberty had turned into a tyrant of unheard-of despotic arbitrariness. The convinced and unconditional opponent of the death penalty, not just for political crimes but for the most heinous offences, who could not, as it were, watch a chicken being killed, has been transformed outwardly into a leather-clad person with a revolver and, in fact, lost all human likeness. The psychological transformation of Russian Jews was probably not all that surprising to the Russians themselves, given Gorky's finding that Russians prior to the revolution saw Jews as possessed of cruel egoism, and that they were concerned about becoming slaves of the Jews. Gorky himself remained a Philo-Semite to the end, despite the prominent Jewish role in the murder of approximately 20 million of his ethnic kin. But after the revolution, he commented that the reason for the current anti-Semitism in Russia is the tactlessness of the Jewish Bolsheviks. The Jewish Bolsheviks, not all of them, but some irresponsible boys, are taking part in the defiling of the holy sites of the Russian people. They have turned churches into movie theatres and reading rooms without considering the feelings of the Russian people. However, Gorky did not blame the Jews for this. The fact that the Bolsheviks sent the Jews, the helpless and irresponsible Jewish youths, to do these things does smack of provocation, of course, but the Jews should have refrained. Those who carried out the mass murder and dispossession of the Russian peasants saw themselves, at least in their public pronouncements, as doing what was necessary in pursuit of the greater good. This was the official view not only of the Soviet Union, where Jews formed a dominant elite, but also was the more or less official view among Jewish intellectuals in the United States and elsewhere. It is still far more common for leftist intellectuals to bemoan McCarthyism than the horrors of the USSR. It is for the sake of creating a perfect human being, Apollonian in body and Mercurian in mind, that Levinson steels himself for doing what is necessary, including the requisitioning of a weeping farmer's last pig and the killing of a wounded comrade too weak to be evacuated. The greater the personal responsibility for acts ordinarily considered evil, the more visible the signs of election and the inner strength they bespoke, demonic as well as Promethean. Bolshevik commissars carried within them the pain of historical necessity. Levinson, a character in A. Fadeev's The Rout, a prominent example of socialist realism in the early Soviet period, is not ideologically Jewish, but there is little doubt that for reasons of both aesthetic and sociological verisimilitude, canonical Jewishness seemed an appropriate expression of the Bolshevik vision of disembodied consciousness triumphing over peasant inertia. So it is not surprising that Gorky's mild rebuke of Jewish anti-Christian zealotry was too much for Esther Frumkina, a leader of the party's Jewish section. Frumkina accused Gorky of attacking Jewish communists for their selfless struggle against darkness and fanaticism. In their self-perceptions, Jews are selflessly altruistic, even when acting out ancient hatreds. Sleskin's last and longest chapter describes the three great Jewish migrations of the 20th century, to Israel, to America, and to the urban centres of the Soviet Union. Sleskin perceives all three through the lens of heroic Jewish self-perception. He sees the United States as a Jewish utopia, precisely because it had only a vestigial establishment tribalism that could not long inhibit Jewish ascendancy. The United States stood for unabashed Mercurianism, non-tribal statehood, and the supreme sovereignty of capitalism and professionalism. It was, rhetorically, a collection, if homines rationalistici artificiales, a nation of strangers held together by a common celebration of separateness or individualism and rootlessness or immigration. It was the only modern state in which a Jew could be an equal citizen and a Jew, at the same time. America offered full membership without complete assimilation. Indeed, it seemed to require an affiliation with a sub-national community as a condition of full membership in the political nation. Slezkin sees post-World War II America as a Jewish utopia, but seems only dimly aware that Jews, to a great extent, created their own utopia in the US by undermining nativist sentiments that were common at least until after World War II. Slezkin emphasizes the Jewish role in institutionalizing the therapeutic state, but sees it as completely benign rather than an aspect of the culture of critique that undermined the ethnic identities of white Americans. By bringing Freudianism to America and by adopting it briefly as a salvation religion, Jews made themselves more American while making America more therapeutic. There is little discussion of the main anti-nativist intellectual movements, all of which were dominated by ethnically conscious Jews: Boasian anthropology, Horace Kallen and the development of the theory of America as a proposition nation, and the Frankfurt School, which combined psychoanalysis and Marxism into a devastating weapon against the ethnic consciousness of white Americans. Nor does he discuss the role of Jewish activist organizations in altering the ethnic balance of the United States by promoting large-scale immigration from around the world. Slezkin also views the Jewish migration to Israel as heroic. In both Jewish Palestine, the Yeshiv, and Soviet Russia, brotherhood stood for the full identity of all true believers, always the few against the many, and their complete identification with the cause, ardently desired and genuinely felt by most young Jews in both places. Eventually, both revolutions evolved in the direction of greater hierarchy, institutionalized militarism, intense anxiety about aliens, and the cult of generals, boy soldiers, and elite forces. But between 1917 and the mid-1930s, they were overflowing with youthful energy and the spirit of fraternal effort and self-sacrifice. The passage is remarkable both for its pinpointing the in-group, out-group nature of the psychology of traditional Jewish groups, freed now of the Torah and the synagogue, and for its description of the in-group psychology of mass murder in the USSR and ethnic cleansing in the Middle East, as involving valiant self-sacrifice and pride in accomplishment. But Slezkin spends most of his energy, by far, in providing a fascinating chronicle of the Jewish rise to elite status in all areas of Soviet society, culture, the universities, professional occupations, the media, and government. In all cases, Jewish overrepresentation was most apparent at the pinnacles of success and influence. To take just the area of culture, Jews were highly visible as avant-garde artists, formalist theorists, polemicists, movie makers, and poets. They were among the most exuberant crusaders against bourgeois habits during the Great Transformation, the most disciplined advocates of socialist realism during the Great Retreat from revolutionary internationalism, and the most passionate prophets of faith, hope, and combat during the Great Patriotic War against the Nazis. And as their critics noticed, Jews were involved in anti-Christian propaganda. Mikhail Bulgakov, a Russian writer, noticed that the publishers of Godless magazine were Jews. He was stunned to find that Christ was portrayed as a scoundrel and a cheat. It is not hard to see whose work it is. This crime is immeasurable. Some of the juxtapositions are striking and seemingly intentional. On page 230, Lev Kopolev is quoted on the need for firmness in confiscating the property of the Ukrainian peasants. Kopolev, who witnessed the famine that killed 7 to 10 million peasants, stated, "You mustn't give in to debilitating pity. We are the agents of historical necessity. We are fulfilling our revolutionary duty. We are procuring grain for our socialist fatherland for the five-year plan." On the next page, Slezkin describes the life of the largely Jewish elite in Moscow and Leningrad, where they attended the theatre, sent their children to the best schools, had peasant women for nannies, spent weekends at pleasant dashes, and vacationed at the Black Sea. Slezkin describes the NKVD as one of the most Jewish of all Soviet institutions, and recounts the Jewish leadership of the Great Terror of the 1930s. On page 256, he writes that in 1937, the prototypical Jew who moved from the Pale of Settlement to Moscow to man elite positions in the Soviet state probably would have been living in elite housing in downtown Moscow, with access to special stores, a house in the country, and a live-in peasant nanny or maid. At least once a year, she would have travelled to a Black Sea sanatorium or a mineral spa in the Caucasus. Sleskin writes long and lovingly detailed sketches of life at the dashes of the elite. The open verandas overlooking small gardens enclosed by picket fences or wildly overgrown yards. But the reader is left to his own imagination to visualise the horrors of the Ukrainian famine and the liquidation of the kulaks. As Sleskin notes, most of the Soviet elite were not Jews, but Jews were far overrepresented among the elite, and Russians far underrepresented as a percentage of the population. Moreover, the Jews formed a far more cohesive core than the rest of the elite because of their common social and cultural background. The common understanding that the new elite had a very large Jewish representation resulted in pervasive anti-Jewish attitudes. In 1926, an agitprop report noted, "The sense that the Soviet regime patronises the Jews, that it is the Jewish government, that the Jews cause unemployment, housing shortages, college admissions problems, price rises, and commercial speculation, this sense is instilled in the workers by all the hostile elements. If it does not encounter resistance, the wave of anti-Semitism threatens to become, in the very near future, a serious political question." Such widespread public perceptions about the role of Jews in the new government led to aggressive surveillance and repression of anti-Jewish attitudes and behaviour, including the execution of Russian nationalists who expressed anti-Jewish attitudes. These public perceptions also motivated Jews to adopt a lower profile in the regime, as with Trotsky, who refused the post of Commissar of Internal Affairs because it might lend further ammunition to the anti-Jewish arguments. From 1927 to 1932, Stalin established an ambitious public campaign to combat anti-Semitism that included 56 books published by the government and an onslaught of speeches, mass rallies, newspaper articles and show trials aimed at eradicating the evil. Jews were able to maintain themselves as an elite until the end of the Soviet regime in 1991. This despite an official push for affirmative action style programs to open up opportunities for the children of peasants and workers in the 1930s and to blunt the anti-Jewish feelings simmering at the lower levels of Soviet society. Jewish elite status persisted despite the Great Terror of the late 1930s, which disproportionately affected the political elite. On the whole, Jews were underrepresented as victims of the Great Terror, and although the Jewish percentage of the political elite did decline after the purges of the late 30s and the promotion of former peasants and working-class Russians, this did not affect Jewish predominance as a professional, cultural, and managerial elite. Jews also retained their elite status despite Stalin's campaign in the late 40s against Jewish ethnic and cultural institutions and their spokesmen. Jewish elite status remained even after the purge was expanded to all sectors of the Soviet elite, due at least partly to the widespread sense among Russians that the great victory in World War II entitled them to a greater role in decision-making. Sleskin shows the very high percentages of Jews in various institutions in the late 40s, including the universities, the media, the foreign service, and the secret police. For example, the deans of philosophers, historians, and legal scholars were ethnic Jews, and as already noted, Jews constituted 80% of the Soviet Academy of Science Institute of Literature. As for the Jewish role as vanguard of the working class, Jews still made up 23% of the staff at the Trade Union Council's publication, TRAD, even after a purge that cut their numbers in half. The campaign against the Jews began only after the apogee of mass murder and deportations in the USSR, and was much less lethal than those mounted against a long list of other ethnic groups, whose typical fate was deportation under the most brutal of circumstances. Cossacks, Chechens, Crimean Tatars, Volga Germans, Moldavians, Kalmyks, Karachai, Bulgars, Ingush, Greeks, Bulgars, Crimean Armenians, Meskhetian Turks, Kurds, and Khemshins. The campaign against the Jews was also much less consistent and effective than the Soviet campaigns against the children of the former elite, the factory owners, the Cossack officers, and the middle classes and intelligentsia had been. Unlike the purges of the 30s that sometimes targeted Jews as members of the elite, albeit at far less than their percentage of the elite, the anti-Jewish actions of the late 40s and early 50s were targeted at Jews because of their ethnicity. Similar purges were performed throughout Soviet-controlled Eastern Europe. All three regimes, Poland, Romania, Hungary, resembled the Soviet Union of the 1920s, insofar as they combined the ruling core of the old communist underground, which was heavily Jewish, with a large pool of upwardly mobile Jewish professionals, who were, on average, the most trustworthy among the educated and the most educated among the trustworthy. Speaking of the situation in Poland, Khrushchev supported the anti-Jewish purge with his remark that "you have already too many Abramovich's." Whereas in the 1920s and 30s, children of the pillars of the old order were discriminated against, now Jews were not only being purged because of their vast overrepresentation among the elite, but were being discriminated against in university admissions. Jews, the formerly loyal members of the elite and willing executioners of the bloodiest regime in history, now found themselves among the aliens. Rather than rationalize their persecution as resulting from the iron laws of history, some Jews began to feel guilt for their former role. A Jewish woman writes that after her husband was arrested, her maid told her, "You are crying now, but you did not mind when my father was being de-kulakized, martyred for no reason at all, and my whole family thrown out in the street." And so began the exodus of Jews. Stalin died, and the anti-Jewish campaign fizzled. But the Jewish trajectory was definitely downhill. The Jews retained their elite status and occupational profile until the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, but the special relationship between the Jews and the Soviet state had come to an end. Or rather, the unique symbiosis in pursuit of world revolution had given way to a unique antagonism over two competing and incommensurate nationalisms. A response to the Russians was massive affirmative action, aimed at giving greater representation to underrepresented ethnic groups. Jews were targets of suspicion because of their ethnic status, barred from some elite institutions, and limited in their opportunities for advancement. The Russians were taking back their country, and it wasn't long before Jews became leaders of the dissident movement and began to seek to emigrate in droves to the United States, Western Europe, and Israel. Despite still possessing elite social status, and far fewer disabilities than many groups, for example, the overwhelming majority of the Soviet population was not allowed to live in cities and some Christian sects were banned, Jews perceived their situation as unrelieved humiliation. Overt anti-Semitism was encouraged by the more covert official variety apparent in the limits on Jewish advancement. Under these circumstances, Jews became, in many ways, the core of the anti-regime intelligentsia. Jewish dissidents, whose parents had run the gulags, the deportations, and the state-sponsored famines, now led the urgent call for social justice. Jewish academics with cult followings, a familiar Jewish pattern, and close ties to Western Jewish intellectuals, became the intellectual vanguard and iconoclasts of the new culture of critique in the Soviet Union. Applications to leave the USSR increased dramatically after Israel's Six-Day War of 1967, which, as in the United States and Eastern Europe, resulted in an upsurge of Jewish identification and ethnic pride. The floodgates were eventually opened by Gorbachev in the late 1980s, and by 1994, 1.2 million Soviet Jews had emigrated, 43% of the total. By 2002, there were only 230,000 Jews left in the Russian Federation, 0.16% of the population. These remaining Jews, nevertheless, exhibit the typical Ashkenazi pattern of high achievement and overrepresentation among the elite, including six of the seven oligarchs who emerged in control of the Soviet economy and media in the period of denationalization. Perhaps, unsurprisingly, this denouement did not result in any sense of collective guilt among Soviet Jews or among their American apologists. Indeed, American Jewish media figures who were blacklisted because of communist affiliations in the 1940s are now heroes, honoured by the film industry, praised in newspapers, and their work exhibited in museums. At the same time, the cause of Soviet Jews and their ability to emigrate became a critical rallying point for American Jewish activist organisations and a defining feature of neoconservatism as a Jewish intellectual and political movement. For example, Richard Perl, a key neoconservative, was Senator Henry Jackson's most important security advisor from 1969 to 1979 and organized congressional support for the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, linking US-Soviet trade to the ability of Jews to emigrate from the Soviet Union. The bill was passed over strenuous opposition from the Nixon administration. Jewish activist organizations and many Jewish historians portray the Soviet Jewish experience as a sojourn in the land of the Red Pharaohs. The historical legacy is that Jews were the passive, uncomprehending victims of the White Armies, the Nazis, the Ukrainian Nationalists, and the post-war Soviet state. Nothing more. Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for part 4 of Stalin's Willing Executioners here at RadioAlbion.com.